Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM, Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Well, we have company coming right around production time for me, so this week I'm doing a double feature. I've chosen a couple of episodes that were produced by Ken Lane right around this time of year. The first episode is Mojave Madness Holy Harvest from November 3rd, 2017. Topics include Brendan Mays' idea of how two conflicting harvest celebrations might work together for his profit. Enjoy.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the American desert, and things are always falling on something or other, hopefully not on you and yours. Although I did see a very bright meteor the other night, and I wondered, where did that thing fall? The Old Woman meteorite crashed out of the sky and into the Old Woman Mountains in the Mojave some 10,000 years ago, but it wasn't until 1975 that a couple of desert miners discovered the giant chunk of space iron. It was nestled between common granite boulders. Well, the miners were pretty excited. After all, this would turn out to be the biggest meteorite ever found in California and the second biggest ever recovered in the whole of the United States. The size of a kitchen stove, iron from space. Well, as often happens in the desert, the finders did not end up being the keepers, as the Interior Department successfully argued that the meteorite was not discovered on the miner's claim, but on Bureau of Land Management land, and it was a meteorite of public scientific interest. After a long battle, the Old Woman meteorite went on display at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., but only for 2 years, from 1978 to 1980. Then it was returned on permanent loan from the Smithsonian, not to the miners, but to California. And you can see this fantastic thing today, minus a slice the Smithsonian cut out for study, at the Desert Discovery Center in downtown Barstow. It's a great desert museum. It's made up of these sand-colored domes. It looks like Luke Skywalker is going to zoom by on his way to Tashi Station to screw around with his friends again. And there are living desert tortoises that roam the museum and gardens freely when it's warm enough. So stop on by. People can go crazy over desert rocks they find. And one day soon, we'll tell some mining stories, but not tonight, not on this particular crisp autumn night, with a sky full of stars and also that very bright moon. It's the full moon tonight. Get out there and take a look. Remind yourself we live on a planet. A planet that is orbited by a subplanet, which we call the moon, because what else would you call it? La Luna. Very bright. It's almost too much out on the desert, because there are not a lot of trees to filter the moonlight to soften its harsh glare. But oh, it makes for a nice nighttime walk. Especially when you don't have to worry about stepping on a rattlesnake or having a centipede squirm into your shoe. Your left shoe. You might want to shake that thing out. The junipers generally aren't tall enough to serve as much of a tree. A Joshua tree is a tree, or close enough, sometimes, especially on the Arizona Strip and out on Sima Dome, where these monster yuccas rise 30 feet high with arms grasping up like some kraken from the briny deep. And that kind of Joshua tree will filter the moonlight, all right. You don't want that harsh moonlight right on your face because it drives people mad. It's bad news. If you sleep with that terrible glare upon you, you don't really sleep. You're just absorbing that white lunar reflection, unable to dream, unable to rest. Like trying to sleep with a flashlight in your face. Or trying to sleep with an iPhone in your face, because that is what we do now. The very worst thing for the daily and nightly cycles of your brain to stare at some social network or video game on your phone when you're trying to shut down and sleep. And instead you're blasting your tired brain through the eye holes with the kind of blue light that disrupts the production of the hormone that tells you to go to sleep. The light from a campfire will sing you to sleep like a baby, but the light from the $100 a month garbage machine makes it so you can't sleep at all. It's like a full moon every night in your eyes, minus the nice walk outside. The finest thing about a full moon is that you can take that nighttime walk in the desert without any LED flashlight to disrupt the system being you can see everything without it. You don't need it. A crisp autumn night in the high desert, nothing is better. Since the last broadcast, every day I have been receiving letters, emails, actually, regarding a sort of romantic army of planet-saving warrior priestesses and priests acting upon the humanist goals of a global revolutionary order, one that would help shepherd us through this strange and dangerous time so that we might survive this challenging era, maintain our home planet as an ideal habitat for our species in the coming millennia, etc., and etc. This proposal, such as it was, sort of veered off from imagining an alternate U.S. Department of the Interior, which will in time lose its current leadership to the federal prison system, but which at its root is made up of good people. People who quietly work to save the nation's heritage, its inspirational landscapes, its biological diversity, its great protected public lands that have made the Western United States the most beautiful, the most photographed, perhaps the most Instagrammed of all the regions of this beautiful world. You hear people talk about these magnificent vistas like it's a holy experience, and it is. I mean, a desert mountaintop could mightily impress Jesus of Galilee back in the day, and the world was far less crowded, the desert open and wild because it could not be farmed. The arid land barely able to provide for nomadic goat herders. Well, you add a couple thousand years and 7 billion additional people, there were only 300 million people on the whole planet in Jesus' time, so the entire population of Earth would be a rounding error today. And an open desert vista is a rare and precious experience for the people of our time, most of whom live crowded together in increasingly massive super cities like Los Angeles and Beijing. It seems we are muddling through something like the Middle Ages right now, the Dark Ages of Western Europe. Now, progress doesn't stop, but it slows considerably. Imagine the people who grew up in the first part of the last century. If you grew up in the 1940s or the 1950s, you watched the world and the species change not over decades, but single years. For good and bad, but always big. television, polio vaccine, atomic bomb, the jet age, the space age, the computer, one after another. You may have noticed that most people seem to be getting a bit simple. If you've ever flipped through a book of early medieval art, you see a rapid decline in basic skill, basic competency. From the steady perfection of classical realism to the homely and simple shapes lacking perspective and detail. In part because the more symbolic art of northern and Celtic tribes had merged with the Christian art of the imperial era. In part because Byzantine icons were in steady production as the old Greek and Roman techniques of bodily perfection no longer appealed to a population which was only interested in the flesh when it was punished and torn apart by mortification. But less skill and ability is notable not just in the general population, but among the elites, and especially among the belongings of the elites. Things ultimately improved over centuries, but if you were royalty in the early medieval time, it did not matter how much gold you controlled, because instead of a beautiful marble statue, you could at best expect a childish cartoon for a portrait with bug eyes and a lopsided skull. By the 7th century of our era, the population of Europe was down to about 18 million people, from the British Isles to the Black Sea. That's 5 million less people than live today in Southern California alone. But progress did not come to a stop. Alchemy led the way with the idea that quiet contemplation and laboratory ritual would lead to an understanding of nature and the cosmos, which could lead to transcendence. Scattered advances in agriculture and architecture would explode into great movements in the centuries to come, and the historians of the 20th century eventually conceded that the Dark Ages were not completely dark, despite the struggle for civilization to survive, despite the plagues and the ignorance, the rule by morons and degenerates, the rise of the vulgarians. But through every grim phase of humanity, there have been those who kept the faith, so to speak, not so much faith in this or that religion, but faith in humanity, a vision for the future. Even Christopher Columbus, in his brutal idiocy, could still imagine an earthly paradise, the literal promise of his Lord who told his disciples the kingdom of God is spread over the earth and men do not see it. Peter C. writes to the program, seeking further information on park ranger role, currently helplessly reacting to the deeds of the evildoers, would prefer to assist in the transmutation and salvation of our planet and humanity. Alexander P. writes, it has been 5 years since I took any kind of vacation, and when I stumbled across your journal and later podcast, well, that was all the inspiration I needed to finally get out of here, and now I don't want to leave. I'm sure you've heard this from many people, but it's easy to fall in love with this place. I am looking for a life change. I've been slogging 9 to 5 for 20 years and I'm done. I need to get away from all the people, from all the noise, and I'd like to come out here and make a difference. Ultimately, I'd like to follow in my grandfather's footsteps. He was a forest ranger in the former Yugoslavia, so I would like to be a park ranger out here and educate people on desert ecology. Carl Y. writes, inspired words tonight, sign me up. Regarding the Warrior Monk Brigade, I'll await my marching orders at the November 16 event. Or at least, hopefully, hear some more desert fire and brimstone. And Steve H. writes, sign me up for whatever political movement, scout troop, religious order, militia, or local club you're talking about in episode 12, I want in. I'm a high desert part-timer and weekender as I attempt to work out a more permanent escape from Los Angeles, and I can't tell you how much I enjoy Desert Oracle the Quarterly. I have every issue, and they bear rereading, bringing new enjoyment each time. Even better, though, in this listener's opinion, is Desert Oracle Radio. That's it. Just a note of appreciation. Thank you, Steve. Thank all of you for these kind and inspiring notes. And a note of appreciation is the nicest thing that you can give to another person, unless you owe them money. In which case, pay them back if you can and lay low if you can't. When a lot of people are thinking about the same thing at the same time, or at least the same kind of thing, it's bound to happen. Carl Jung noticed this in the years before World War II broke out in Europe, because so many of his patients were having the same dreams. Dreams like something from a Bosch painting, dreams that could not be comprehended until after the war, when the full horrors of Nazi Germany became public knowledge. And we will continue to think about this opportunity and attempt to conduct ourselves in such a way as to turn such yearnings into a broader reality. It happens all the time, and it might as well happen for you, for us, for good. Why not? People make up worse things every day. Just look at Silicon Valley. You are listening to Sounds from Joshua Tree, from an artist known as Red Blue Black Silver, redblueblacksilver.com, on Desert Oracle Radio. Halloween has come and gone, and as has become the unpleasant norm in our desert, we did not get Halloween weather until Halloween Day itself, which is better than missing it altogether. The tiny, scattered human settlements of our broadcast area, the Mojave High Desert, mostly lack the kind of places where children can trick-or-treat, and where teenagers can wander the midnight streets like feral dogs wearing hockey masks, and adults can stagger out of 2 a.m. bar rooms in smeared makeup and falling apart costumes for a romantic walk home down the autumn sidewalks. We don't have sidewalks around here, and the houses are too far apart for trick-or-treating, and besides, a lot of the old thumpers up here are against the whole thing in principle. The principle being that they simply don't care for these ancient autumn festivals of the pre-Christian cultures. Somewhat in the way that the European conquerors of Central and South America found the rich civilizations there so distasteful that all the holy books, all the history books, the religious books, the mathematical books, all the writings of those great civilizations were burned whenever they were found. What survived only survived because the writings were not discovered at the time, because they were hidden away by plan or by accident. The arrival of the Harvest Festival was one of those 1980s inventions that you hoped would go away. But this peculiar variation of the satanic panic has persisted in the semi-rural and exurban parts of the country, where times are always tougher and we tend to look past the devils among us for the devil we've imagined. It's a suburban church version of Halloween, minus the cheery reminders of death, the skeletons and such, the death that is coming for all of us sooner or later, and perhaps long before we are prepared for it. As Halloween is already a harvest festival, like Thanksgiving that follows it, at an American harvest festival, there are still plenty of pumpkins, and there are straw bales, and mostly pumpkins and straw bales, and no faces on the pumpkins. We welcome Brendan Mays back to the program. And unfortunately, we could not have you on before the Halloween festival that you put on last weekend. And unfortunately, there has been some controversy about how it played out.
we had a couple of problems with the haunted hayride. We have this, as you know, the event was supposed to, it was supposed to be multi-stage. You know, it was supposed to be across multiple stages. We're going to have various events for various people, various themes. We had three main themes going, as you know. We had the voodoo theme, which was kind of a New Orleans-based Creole sort of voodoo, satanic ritual-themed area of the Mojave Madness happening. Then we also, of course, we had a very popular Dia de los Muertos. We thought it was going to be popular, at least. Dia de los Muertos stage was a giant ziggurat, a pyramid. You know, that's the one of the things that got people kind of really upset from the Harvest Festival is that, well, at the top, you know, you lead the gal out there and she's dressed, you know, rather scantily, and she's take her up to the top and the high priest drains her heart down a sluice. And of course, it's not real blood. It's actually chocolate liqueur. The attendees gather at the bottom of the trough and slop, you know, drink from the trough and have a good time like you're supposed to. I guess that was one of the things that really, really upset the harvest people. We had an area for children. Good white witches, you know, who practice, you know, the Sabbath, the S-balls, you know, the celebration of the seasons. One of the guys, we were running out of animals because everybody wants to be a bighorn sheep, you know, everybody wants to be a hawk or a something, you know, the great animals. So we were handing out insect names because we'd run out all the good animals. And so we named this one guy the Brown Recluse, and he ran with it, you know, all eight legs. And then we had a more traditional haunted hayride. I guess some things kind of went wrong on the haunted hayride. It was supposed to be pretty simple in practice. We were hiring a bunch of community college kids to come by. We had hired a bunch of kids. These kids, I got to say, during the interview process, they kind of scared me. And they weren't even in costume. But they kind of crazy kids. And anyway, they were dressed up as ghouls and goblins and zombies and all your typical stuff. And well, you know how a haunted hayride works. You hook up a big tractor. You hook up a big tractor to a trailer. You fill a trailer with hay. All the people pile on the hay. The tractor drives through, you know, various setups and stops, and then all the zombies come out, roar, you know, and they kind of mess with you and attack you. We have a staged hanging scene, you know, where someone gets hung, they fall off the scaffold and all that. And I guess some of these college kids, well, they looked pretty crazed, like I said, before they were even in costume. And I think maybe some of them had personal problems or something. Maybe they were hard up for money for various reasons. And I think maybe some of them got a little too physical with the attendees. And maybe during their kind of physical interactions, you know, they come up and they try to grab your girlfriend. You put your arm around her, and it's romantic and scary all at the same time. And I think maybe some guy and I got carried away and maybe reached in and grabbed some things that weren't theirs. And I don't know what they did with this stuff. I'm not sure about this church event volunteer thing. Now, they were told right from the get-go that this was going to be a volunteer thing. No one's going to get paid any money. This was just a fun way to spend an evening. No one was tricked into working this event. It's going to be a good time. This is about economies of scale. We took their money in good faith, and we promised to give them a harvest festival that they could be proud of. And we did set up a harvest festival right next to the dance stage, right next to the DJs, separated by a black wall, so they wouldn't have to say, now, of course, you're going to hear it, obviously. But they didn't give us very much money at all, and we had to fight them for the little meager amount that they gave us. They said they'd collected it over four or five Sundays. I guess there's not a lot of money out there, but we didn't get hardly anything from them, and we said that to them. We're going to need at least, I don't want to say what the dollar amount was, because I don't think...
The amount reported was $12,500.
Okay, well, $12,500. Let's see, what does that buy? Maybe that buys two permits. That buys a county permit. That buys a septic permit. That buys a permit for a portable. That buys you what? Three portable toilets? I mean, what did they expect to get? They were going to get, unfortunately, with the economy the way it is, the economic reality is $12,000 is not enough to put on a harvest festival worthy of such a fantastic and wonderful place as Joshua Tree is. And we just couldn't do it for $12,000. And we told them that. They knew that. We said, hey, look, we're also throwing Mojave Madness. Would it be all right if we were to use some of the resources from Mojave Madness and share them with the Holy Harvest Festival, and we could maybe make both festivals work together? Not on, no one's intermingling necessarily, everything's separated, but we can get double use out of the toilet facilities, double use out of the concession stands, double use out of the permits for the grounds. We're going to be separated by a wall. You're not going to see them. They're not going to see you. You'll have your Harvest Festival on one side, and we'll have Mojave Madness on the other side. Now, I can't help it that their kids or whomever, their congregation, wanted to sneak through the line and come over to Mojave Madness and have a good time. I can't help it. They didn't seem to be offended to me. I saw all those young Christians rocking it out to Marshmello and Don Diablo, our DJs. They seemed to love them a lot. You know, they're dancing with everybody else. Seemed like they were having a good time. So their complaints that some sort of satanic things happened, or we were corrupting their youth, or we were trying to inject the occult into their lives, is not true. If anything, Ken, we were exposing them in a safe environment, secure environment, to an alternative viewpoint that they could, hey, they could just sit there and judge it. Say, hey, kids, look at this. You don't want to be like these freaks, you know? Or how about people on our side? They look over there and say, hey, those people are having a nice, wholesome festival. Maybe I'll go over there and get some pumpkin spice latte or whatever the heck they're serving over there. Maybe I'll have some nice squash pie. Maybe I'll go into the gourd juggling competition and try my hand at gourd juggling. 5 drug arrests is not a lot of drug arrests. I'm sorry. And yes, they were hard drugs. And yes, there were a couple of weapons found, but that's the standard for any of these large events. You know that, Ken. All these big EDM festivals in Las Vegas, these kids are dying. Nobody died at our event, and I consider that a success.
Around the Mojave, across the Mojave, from Amboy to Zizek's Pioneer Town to Pipes Canyon, 29 Palms to Wonder Valley. Many of those places are actually very close to each other. This has been Desert Oracle Radio, KCDZ 107.7 FM in the high desert. Come watch it happen live, November 16 at the Ace Hotel in Palm Springs, Desert Oracle Radio. Live and recorded for broadcast. Free reserved seating, few seats left at Eventbrite. Find the link at desertoracle.com. Send us mail if you'd like to receive Desert Oracle magazine. Send us money. $25 for 4 issues. Desert Oracle, P.O. Box 1735, Joshua Tree, California. We are here Friday nights at 10 p.m. And you can get the podcast of the broadcast on the internet, iTunes, Stitcher, and the rest. Please drive safely out there. Halloween's over, but the monsters are still out there, still waiting for you. Good night from the Voice of the Desert.
We are at the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Our next episode is Return of the Mojave Phone Booth, from November 17th, 2017. It was one of Ken Lane's live recordings, and from the sound of it, his guests had been celebrating something. Enjoy.
Well, we are broadcasting from Palm Springs in the California desert tonight. Now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio. It is nighttime in the desert, as you can see by looking around. And on this night, the desert in question is here in Palm Springs at the Ace Hotel with the mountains rising up behind us. And please silence your phone devices as we are recording. The best way to silence a phone is to throw it in that pool. Thank you for being here on this autumn night. Palm trees, a campfire ring outside, a hint of what it was like here a century ago, 100 years ago, when the few people who lived here lived in the canyons. They lived in Palm Canyon, they lived in Chino Canyon, where you had shade, where you had fresh water, where you could grow some beans and plants, hot springs for winter soaking. Really a perfect oasis. For centuries, this has been the home to the Cahila people, the Agua Caliente tribe. Today, the tribe owns 50 square miles of Palm Springs in the Coachella Valley, all the way down to Rancho Mirage. The land beneath 20,000 homes and businesses here is still tribal land, and you pay a lease to the tribe. Anglo-Americans showed up around the gold rush, as usual, and by the early 1900s, there were health resorts. There were health resorts catering to the lungers. The lungers who suffered various diseases, tuberculosis primarily among them, they came to the desert for the dry air, for the mineral baths. In the time before the antibiotic cure was discovered for tuberculosis in 1949, but in those early days, there was another kind of Anglo-American resident, a new kind of maniac, a person we call a desert rat. The desert rats loved this landscape. They loved the arid land. They loved the brilliant colors. They loved the extremes that we call the Colorado Desert, the part of the Sonoran Desert that is west of the Colorado River. These desert rats were artists and philosophers, misfits, philosophers, outlaws, generally not very fond of busy cities and the busy work of American life. They were talented painters, they were writers, and they also included a strange character named Edmund Yeager, the man we call Dr. Yeager, a desert biologist, a pioneering desert biologist. He lived in a wooden shack in Palm Canyon. He built it himself and with a little help from his friends, and he traveled these desert lands his whole adult life, making great discoveries. There weren't a lot of scientists looking at the flora and fauna of the desert before Dr. Yeager. His best-known discovery, was of the first known hibernating bird, the common whorewill, which he found sleeping in nooks along the rock walls east of here, a place protected by the Nature Conservancy and known as the Edmund Yeager Nature Sanctuary in the Chuckwalla Mountains. You should visit in the cold months. It's about an hour east of here on Interstate 10. Take the exit just before Desert Center to Dirt Road and say hello to Dr. Yeager while you were visiting, because his ashes were put there, spread among his nature preserve after his death in 1983. In time, the health resorts became country clubs, tennis clubs, golf courses, and the whole place became so fancy that American presidents made a habit of vacationing here. They liked to be here because it was far from the gloomy cold of Washington, D.C., the grim winters of the Northeast coast. Dwight Eisenhower first landed in Palm Springs in February 1954, and he was here to play golf. There were just two 18-hole golf courses here at the time, and Ike played both because he loved golf, as presidents generally do, regardless of their other qualities. On the night of February 20th, something happened, something still unexplained. Eisenhower disappeared from Smoketree Ranch. This was the elaborate estate owned by Paul Helms of Helms Bakery in Los Angeles. The White House press corps could not get a straight story. They did not know what happened to Ike. In the confusion that followed, the Associated Press put out a 10-bell bulletin announcing that President Eisenhower was dead. Quote, President Eisenhower died tonight of a heart attack in Palm Springs. That's what the AP reported. 2 minutes later, they retracted the bulletin. And they said it was a mistake. A lack of information had brought on an international panic. A well-known local dentist, Francis A. Purcell, was later credited with repairing a broken crown on the president's front left incisor. That is tooth number 11 in dental lingo. The president, according to the White House, had broken the crown while eating fried chicken, and he was hurried away for a secret dental visit. But Dr. Purcell, later a founding board member of the College of the Desert here, had no records of the procedure. He could not remember any details about it, although both he and his wife, Mrs. Purcell, could remember everything about the steak fry they attended the next night and where Dr. Purcell was thanked for perhaps fixing Eisenhower's crown, or perhaps just taking credit for something that was never done. A strange story emerged in the years after Ike's 1954 holiday here, a story that fits in well with the Cold War UFO panic. It had gripped America in the 1950s. Over several weeks in July of 1952, unknown aerial craft had appeared over National Airport in the U.S. Capitol. Both visually and on radar screens at Washington National and at Andrews Air Force Base. They were seen by pilots and flight crews from aircraft and from the ground. And when the fighters were scrambled, the objects vanished from the sky, only to return when the fighter jets landed for refueling. General Eisenhower himself had seen a brilliant blue-white craft appear over the USS Franklin D. Roosevelt, the first American ship armed with nuclear weapons. It was that same year, 1952. It was the year before he was elected, or he became president. He was on deck in the night in his pajamas and his robe. He was there to get coffee and smoke cigarettes when he joined a group of sailors watching the UFO hovering 100 feet off the ocean, just off the ship. He left the sailors with instructions to not talk about this and said he would look into it. All of which adds texture to the persistent story of Ike's real emergency the night of February 20th when he was vacationing here in the Coachella Valley. A late night visit to Muroc Air Force Base for a diplomatic meeting with representatives of an alien civilization. Muroc is now known as Edwards Air Force Base. It's home of the Right Stuff pilots. It's Dry Lake Runway where the space shuttle often landed, where the fastest and most secret American aircraft were tested and flown. But from the beginning there, other aircraft had appeared, mysterious things that would chase pilots through the night sky or hover brazenly over the main runway. Brilliant lights flashing every color, only to rapidly, straight up from 200 or 300 feet over the runway to 40 to 50,000 feet. This maneuver they saved for when the fighter jets were scrambled. In 1954, the story goes, the leader of the free world was taken by helicopter to the Mojave Desert Air Base for a brief and symbolically important meeting with the space aliens. A diplomatic meeting with an intelligence that had baffled the armies of the world for centuries, but especially since World War II, and especially since the people of Earth began using nuclear weapons. The story emerged just 7 weeks later when a letter was sent to California's best-known UFO researcher, the director of the Borderland Sciences Research Association in San Diego. Dignitaries were reportedly brought to the desert base, including the Los Angeles Archbishop, James McIntyre, and the first chairman of the White House Council of Economic Advisors, Edwin Norse. There they saw, along with the president, recovered craft, recovered alien craft, five different shapes and sizes. On this single winter's night on the California desert in 1954, President Dwight D. Eisenhower is reported to have died of a heart attack, sought secret treatment for dental work, broken on a bite of chicken, to have seen recovered UFOs in the Mojave, and to have made diplomatic contact with a race of tall space aliens known then and now as the Nordics. the founder of Borderland Sciences Research Organization. Was Mead Lane, apparently a relative of mine. I never met him. I'd never heard of him. This is his book that he published, Flying Saucers at 1954 Edwards Air Force Base. Well, you may have no doubt noticed a strange structure sharing the stage with us here tonight. And it's time that we address this outrage, and we have to introduce the character who brought this telephone booth all the way from Arizona, from the town of Sholo in the weird American desert, owner-operator of the iconic deuceofclubs.com. He's in every issue of the Desert Oracle, and now he's here. Please welcome Doc Daniels.
Hello, Ken.
Well, hello there, Doc. It's good to see you. You know, this is a call-in radio show, more or less.
Yeah, I'm wondering how you can see me.
Yeah, well, we've got it's like a video phone.
Okay.
So, look, I hope you're comfortable in there. What in God's name are you wearing?
I'm not sure how you know what I'm wearing, Ken, but we came directly from a Halloween party.
Uh-huh.
As soon as we got your telegram.
Long drive?
Yeah, you know how it is in the desert. You get a telegram and you...
Is this the world-famous Mojave phone booth?
Well, unfortunately, no. The world-famous Mojave phone booth was destroyed by the NPS, the National Park Service. This is a replica booth that was built for a movie called, oddly enough, Mojave Phone Booth.
So this is a cheap Hollywood prop.
It's a cheap Hollywood... Well, I don't know how cheap it was. It's built with hinges. It's held together with hinges.
Well, that's solid. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, tell us how you learned about the mysterious booth. How all of that went down. You don't have to... I know you've told the story many times, but...
You don't belabor the point.
give us a three-sentence version, if you'd be so kind.
I read about the Mojave phone booth in a zine, which were homemade zines by my favorite band, Girl Trouble, out of Tacoma, Washington. And there was a letter to the editor that mentioned this phone booth that was allegedly in the middle of the desert and operating. And so I immediately resolved that I would call it at least once every day and record the calls. And I just didn't think anybody would ever answer. I just thought I would like to hear the phone ring in the Mojave Desert.
And presumably, eventually, somebody answered?
After only about 30 days, somebody answered.
30 days.
Yeah.
I believe you had a post-it note about this.
I did have a post-it note. It reminded me to call the phone booth every day. But I didn't need it, because I was doing it all the time. I would do it at work mostly, you know, instead of like tapping your pencil, I would just dial the number and listen to that number. And imagine that I was not at work. I was in the desert.
What was the number?
760-933-9969.
So you caused a international outrage, as
according
I remember.
According to certain government agents, I did. Yes.
Uh-huh. And there were, because as I've told you before, the only times I ever got answers on that phone, which was by the sender mine in the middle of mm-hmm. Mojave Preserve,
mm-hmm.
German tourists, always German tourists, never
Germans
the same
loved
one.
I mean, it was beloved around the world. People just loved calling it. Whenever it would go out of operation for any reason, the poor phone company would get these complaining phone calls from all over the world.
You've written a book called Adventures with the Mojave Phone Booth.
Correct.
And where is that book?
Yeah, the plan was to have some here tonight. I'm sorry. But it's being designed. It's in the hands, actually, of Professor Cardyhouse, one of the main characters in the book. He's doing the book
Professor
design.
Cardyhouse. That's good. He's a professional.
He is very good. He's a professor.
I've heard you have a posse, as we used to say in the
1990s.
And the
there were some other people at the
1890s.
Costume party with me. Daniel,
these are
Pony
the
Boy.
Characters who
there
accompanied you on the early visits to
I'm
the
to
Mojave phone booth. Yeah, plenty of room for everyone. Introduce them, if you will, Doc.
This is Pony Boy Girly Toolshed. Ask her about that at your peril. This is Daniel Paul, who most people call Daniel, but for some reason I always call by his first and last name.
Welcome to the program. Yeah, you can take turns on the... Unfortunately, we only have one phone. It's an old booth.
Hello.
Daniel, can you... What was your first physical encounter with the Mojave phone booth?
Our first physical encounter was Godfrey drove us there in the middle of the night. It was very dark. We drove down a really long, dark road, a dirt road with rocks, and Joshua trees, and some other desert items. And there was a phone booth 45 minutes deep off the SEMA exit off the 15 freeway. That's the location.
45 minutes. And that phone booth was there for?
Therefore, we went to it.
No. There you go. Thank you.
Yes.
All right, now we need to hear.
Okay.
I cannot even remember the nickname you've just been introduced as.
Pony Boy Girly Tool Shed.
Pony Boy Girly Tool Shed. Welcome to the program, Pony,
etc.
Thank
you very much.
And
Thank you. You
also accompanied these ne'er-do-wells on the first trip?
Yes. Yes, I was there.
What was it like? What made it magic?
I think the fact that Doc was so obsessed with calling the phone that it became almost something that we all kind of attached to, this idea that this phone would ring in the middle of nowhere and maybe someday someone might answer it, and then one day someone did. And the fact that he started having a conversation with the woman from the cinder mine there, and it just started this whole routine, and we enjoyed the adventure of road tripping out there. And we never knew if we'd actually get there or not. And we were always going out there in ill-equipped vehicles.
Very ill-equipped.
Sometimes art cars that had a tendency to, I don't know, break down, Godfrey. It just became a thing that we did. And I sent Doc a number of items to bury out at the phone booth, and then he had a contest to see who could find them when they went out there. And it just, it was 1997. So this connectivity was very new and odd and peculiar, and people just loved it, and we loved it.
I loved it, and I just read about it and called occasionally. Well, thank you all so much for bringing the booth and for coming up here. I hear you have some kind of historical roundabout that you're doing.
Yes, that's right.
And it was 20 years ago.
It was 20 years ago this month. Yeah.
And it's the weirdest damn thing, because you all, I, were fascinated by it being a phone booth in the middle of nowhere, as they said. And now the millennials are just fascinated with the idea of a phone booth at all.
That's right.
I mean, it's like having a Egyptian mummy up here.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit more about one of your most popular pieces in the Desert Oracle, which was the tale of the $50,000 jackalope. And a lot of people just don't buy it. They just don't believe anybody.
By which part?
Well, mostly the part about anyone believing you. So.
Well, let me reemphasize that these were bikers from Ohio.
Uh-huh.
Maybe that helps. I don't know.
And where does Ohio lie on the biker IQ?
Until that point, I would have had no idea, but now I feel like it's pretty low. And you might be underselling my ability to sell it. I mean,
well, that's true. That's true.
Yeah.
So how did you tell this person who you worked with about the jackalope and about how she might earn $50,000 by capturing it?
She lived at a trailer park, which is shocking, and she said that she had seen something go underneath one of the trailers. And it sounded from her description very much like it was a cat, probably. But I said, God, that sounds just like a jackalope. And she was like, a jackalope? What now? I was like, well, okay, a jackalope is a cross between a jackrabbit and an antelope. And if you were to capture one, I mean, there are very few known in the wild now. Most of them have been caught and stuffed and displayed in roadside museums. So if you were to catch one live in the wild, you could probably get upwards of $50,000. Man, I just saw the dollar signs in her eyes light up. And by the end of the day, she had that money spent. I mean, she was just going to go home and catch that thing and cash in. So she went home and she told her biker husband about this, and he just belly laughed and couldn't believe that she had believed it. And then she got really angry, and then the next day I had to face the consequences.
Doc, tell us about your next piece in the Desert Oracle, which I think got lost on the same truck as your Mojave phone books.
Okay, this is really embarrassing, but they were asking me, and I couldn't remember what it is.
You could not remember your own piece.
No. What is it? I'm serious.
Well, it's been a while. Yeah. I hear it's a good one, and it will be out. In
you don't remember the, either.
I remember enjoying it tremendously.
I remember what my next one is going to be.
What is your next one?
My next one's going to be on the center of the earth at Felicity, California.
Center of the earth. All right. Well, thank you, Doc Daniels, so much. Thank you for bringing your posse. Good luck on your memory drive, and don't get shot in the desert.
All right. Thank you so much.
Doc Daniels, everybody. And now it is time for Strange and Unusual Facts. A company called American Green has reportedly bought the entire little town of Nipton on the edge of Mojave National Preserve so that the company can pump water from the desert aquifer below and add a few drops of marijuana oil to that water so they can sell it to the tourists who are either coming or going from California or Nevada. Both states with legal recreational marijuana as of January, in California's case. Experts say the company will be mercilessly harassed in the courts until they go away. Illegal campers in the day-use-only county land preserve in the village of Joshua Tree recently left marijuana edibles scattered around their illegal fire ring and illegal campsite, where my dog managed to consume a piece of this ground food and then had to spend 24 hours in the Yucca Valley Pet Hospital, as this program will be broadcast tomorrow night in Joshua Tree. I would like to make it clear that from now on, all illegal campers in this clearly posted day-use-only area are going to symbolically pay for sending my dog to the hospital. I mean, nails in tires, rocks through windshields, tent sliced to ribbons, and then we call the sheriffs, and then we call CAL FIRE and the county parks to report the scumbags. Are you coming to Joshua Tree? Well, listen, camp in a legal campsite, and if that's too tough for you, go to a motel. And if that's too tough for you, go home at night, you know? Go back to Orange County. People up there in the high desert are ticked off. And honestly, the out-of-towners don't really spend that much money up there anyway. In fact, we're going to start charging them per Instagram post. The grasshopper mouse mostly eats centipedes and scorpions. With the scorpion, it eats the stinger first. The grasshopper mouse turns scorpion venom into painkiller. Imagine if being struck by a Mojave rattlesnake made you high. But just imagine it. Don't try it. Leave our rattlesnakes alone, for God's sake. They have enough problems with the highways and the rat poison and the suburbs all over the desert. Joshua trees, one of the most popular plants on social media, may have come to North America as seeds carried in the bellies of migrating birds some 15,000 years ago. Or maybe not, it's a theory. What is a fact is that the giant sloth, common in this area, before the desert we know and love and occasionally despise today, became this area. Well, the sloth ate the flowers and they spread the seeds of the Joshua tree all over what we call the Mojave today. And we know this because Joshua tree seeds have been found in the fossilized excrement of giant sloths in caves around the Mojave. Many interesting activities await the visitor to Joshua Tree National Park. A favorite activity of Graham Parsons of the Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers and Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones, who often traveled out to Joshua Tree together, was to take LSD and then climb up Caprock at night, and then take turns sitting in an old barber's chair that they had dragged up there for the express purpose of watching UFOs without hurting their necks. Graham should have stuck to LSD. Instead, in 1973, Graham Parsons died in room number 8 of the Joshua Tree Inn, right there off the highway. He had indulged in heroin, too much heroin. Regular people die from taking opiates all the time in the high desert these days, but it was seen as a romantic way for a rock star to perish in that long ago time. Today's rock stars, if there are any, are said to enjoy a carbonated water called LaCroix. We shall now quote Dr. Yeager on the subject of the antelope ground squirrel. Sprightly and restless, he is a favorite of all who know him. You are especially fortunate if this chipper little rodent takes up living quarters in the neighborhood of your desert home, for then you may watch him in all his sportive moods and know his engaging family life. He is a decent, friendly neighbor of the finest sort. Anybody who lives in the desert or visits often should have a copy of Eben Yeager's wonderful book, Desert Wildlife, always available somewhere and currently published by Stanford University Press. It has a desert kit fox on the cover. Now, it's said that Dr. Yeager, at one place not marked on a map that we're aware of, in Nevada, a bit north of Las Vegas, had so many scorpions that even Dr. Yeager, the great desert biologist, refused to sleep on the ground. And when he traveled there, he brought a full bed and he made his interns build it. Thank you for joining us for this episode of Desert Oracle Radio, broadcasting across the great Mojave Wilderness from Amboy to Zizek's, Pioneer Town to Wonder Valley, even here in Palm Springs, if you park in just the right place. Subscribe to the show on iTunes and Stitcher and tune in the rest. It's a podcast of the broadcast for those sad and lonesome times when you are not in the high desert where the bighorn sheep and the antelope ground squirrels play. We will enjoy a 15-minute intermission after this, and then we will be back with more Desert Oracle Radio Live, if we live that long. Good night for now, from the voice of the desert.
Thank you, Gallatin Valley, for listening. As always, you can call me and leave a message or text about anything on your mind. The number is 406-404-6246. Remember to spread the word that you can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgbm.org at 7 p.m. Sundays and 9 a.m. Mondays. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgvm.org website. That's it for today. So till next time, listeners, be safe, stay well, and sweet dreams.